though I have located another ship.
Tell me about it, Cormac instructed.
An old polity attack boat, refurbished and most likely privately owned. It is located in a mountain cave system, 5,000 kilometres from Skellor's landing site. All its systems are shut down, and scanning indicates it has not been used in some years, possibly decades.
Any sign of the crew?
Nothing that stands out, though people from the ship could be mingled with the indigenes. No org signals or any other signs of polity technology.
What about that colony ship in orbit?
Virtually inert, and has probably been so for centuries. I get a beacon response to an old-style comm laser frequency, but nothing else. Scanning reveals no one aboard. Skeller could be there using his personal chameleon wear, but as nothing there has been activated or interfered with, the probability is much higher that he's on the surface. I could check that ship out for you, Fethan piped up. I'm getting a bit stir-crazy in this old tin can, and it would be a relief to even go and look around in another.
Something like a snort of pique issued from Jack. Cormac stared at the old cyborg estimatingly, then said, Okay, go and take a look. You go with him, Cento. Power it up, and secure it if you can. The rest of us will go down to the surface and see what we can find out from the human population. Jack, you've been listening in on them?
Yes. Their language is rooted in old standard English with a strong French influence. I can load a linguistic crib program directly to Gant and to you through your grid link, but Thorn will require VR teaching of some hours.
Cormac turned to Thorn. I'll want you on the ground soonest, so get yourself into VR. You're no use to me if you can't understand the answers you beat out of people. That would be most annoying, Thorn replied, standing. When you're ready, take the second lander over to this grounded polity ship and check it out. Then you can rendezvous with us. Thorn nodded. Right, said Cormac to them all. Let's find this bastard. His sensors now directly connected into one of his miniature sentinels, Skellor studied the ship that had destroyed the Vulture and experienced a feeling of unreality. A soldier would feel this way when, peering over the edge of his trench, he saw a bulldozer bearing down on him. For a fraction of a second, he just denied what he was seeing. Then came acceptance and fear. He considered his options. If he ran and hid, he could evade detection for a very long time. But he was still in a trap. It was possible ECS might, after searching meticulously and finding no further evidence he was here, decide that the Vulture, and Crane, should they find him, had been decoys. But that possibility was reliant only on Dragon saying nothing, and he doubted that. ECS might also choose the option of taking this planet out of the equation permanently. But the likelihood was low, what with this place's indigene population and the AI regard for sentient life. Shutting down his link to his sentinels, Skellor stared down at what had become of the man called Plakeest. The man's name was one of the smaller scraps of information Skellor had torn from his mind. Plakeest's arms and legs had withered, their substance having been drawn into his increasingly bloated body. His clothing had parted to reveal skin deeply veined and mottled in shades of purple and yellow. His skull had now collapsed, what remained of his head only retaining enough integrity to accommodate his mouth for breathing and as a birth channel for the org lice still crawling from it. Jane tendrils extruding from his lower body rooted in the sandy soil, seeking out nutrient for the ongoing process. Already, only a few meters away, those tendrils had found a suitable source and had dragged to the earth and were sucking dry one of the slear human hybrids. All about, up the butte, to which this bloated thing bound itself with mucal webs, across the ground, up pillars, and amid the trusses, high above and on the underside of the platform, scuttled hundreds of the org creatures. But there were not enough yet, for Skellor needed thousands if he was to hold a suitable hostage to ransom. However, it was time for the hostage-taking to begin. The exterior input centre looked as if someone had flensed it with autogun fire. Such was its ruination. The grav plates, now working again but utterly disconnected from any form of computer control, had dragged the smoke into laminations and dropped tangles of optics and superconductors and numerous shattered components to the floor. The air was now getting stale and smelt strongly of sweat and fear. "That's the last of them," said Denisan, tossing a memory crystal no bigger than his fingernail into the deep scanning sphere, where all such items had been dumped. Mika hoped it would be enough, for if Jerusalem detected any computer activity, the AI would refuse to send a rescue vessel, and they would have to scour the centre again and again until it was clean. "Okay, everybody," Denisan continued, "all personal comps in here, and anything with any kind of mem storage. That means even memory cloth, knickers, and any items of jewellery holding personal messages. You're all scientists, so you know exactly what I mean." After pulling out its power pack, Mika tossed her thin gun into the sphere. It might not have possessed much in the way of mind, but there was enough there for it to link into any targeting system its owner might decide to wear, and for it to identify its owner, therefore enough to absorb a virus or a worm. She then watched as other items were reluctantly tossed after it. A shirt bearing the slowly shifting images of ancient media stars. Jewellery, probably containing holographic messages from loved ones. Wrist comps, neck comps, ankle comps, palm tops and laptops, and even a pair of boots, though Mika could not fathom what kind of mem storage they might contain. "That's it, Jerusalem," said Denisan finally. Jerusalem replied, "Scan shows no informational activity. You are clear to return to me, though be aware that you will be passing through a further series of scans. So if anyone has forgotten any little items..." Nobody stepped forward. They all knew just how deadly the situation was. That was it, in the end, thought Mika. All this destruction, just to prevent any trace of infection leaving this place. It was fortunate, she supposed, that Jerusalem's paranoia did not extend to the kind of memory storage that sat between her ears, in this situation at least. It occurred to her that the AI had probably assessed as low the probability that the virus infecting exterior input would be sufficiently powerful to find access to the human brain through normal human senses. Even Skellor had only managed to do that through DracoCorp orgs. Something engaged with a clonk, and the centre shuddered, sending people stumbling because the grav plates, no longer computer-controlled, did not compensate. Then the iris over the main door opened, exposing an incredibly long, straight tunnel. "Well, there's our road to Jerusalem," Culver quipped. Mika had expected some sort of rescue craft, but as soon as she entered the telescopic tunnel, she realized that Jerusalem must have extruded it directly from itself. Soon all the staff were weightless inside, dragging themselves the long distance back by using the flimsy wall handles. Behind them, a second iris closed, and it seemed to Mika that, like in a nightmare, no matter how far she travelled, this iris never seemed to recede. Then she realized that the tunnel was contracting from there, its metallofilm sleeves sliding into each other. Later, a brief flash lit the passageway through its translucent walls. "There went external input," Culver observed grimly. How long, Mika wondered, before Jerusalem had to deal with a contaminated human instrument in the same manner? Mr. Crane marched indefatigably through darkness, pausing only to fend off the regular attacks of second-stage sliers that were neither albino nor sapphire-eyed. Then, halfway through the night, these attacks ceased, and he even walked past a third stager crouched atop a low butte, with its nightmare pincers silhouetted against starlit sky, without incurring any reaction. Later, he halted to observe some 20 rear breeder sections of both second and third stages of Slayer in an orgiastic tangle, like mating frogs. He watched them for some time, noting their two-pronged tentacular extrusions intertwining, spilling glutinous fluids and dark blood. How sand got stuck to chitinous limbs and body segments by this mess and was rolled into balls and clods that tumbled stickily away. He had been ordered to keep going until he reached Dragon. But to do that, it was necessary to protect himself, which raised conflicting imperatives. Speciously, he reasoned that he watched these creatures because, when whole, they attacked him. Therefore, he must carefully assess in advance what danger they represented. Never, in the fractured chaos that comprised his mind, did one fragment reveal to another one evidence of that condition called curiosity. At length, the tangle began to unravel, and like revellers heading drunkenly for home, the slear breeder sections began staggering away, some on four legs and some on two, like escapees from the garden of earthly delights. One of these Boschian creatures, Crane noted, was ambushed by the front or hunting section of another slear, and devoured even while the devourer's own breeder section reattached behind it. After the final hardened partiers went on their way, Crane stood and continued on his. And once again, creatures unable to resist investigating anything that moved shot out of the shadows to fracture their mouthparts on his adamantine body. Just before the sunrise, these attacks ceased for a second time, and the reasons for all smaller slears to keep their heads down soon became apparent. Their pincers were huge and lethally sharp-edged, their sawing mandibles larger than any he had seen and also sharp along the opposite side to their saw teeth. Below them and the mouth itself extended two limbs terminating in something that looked exactly like ice axes. In some part of himself, Crane guessed that all these extra horrors had evolved for feeding upon similarly thick-shelled creatures, like saws and hammers and levers used to get at the meat inside. But he was also aware of how they might apply to himself. Those mouthparts were level a metre above his head. The creatures were truly massive, and Crane understood that now he faced a real threat. But what he could not guess was that he was witnessing creatures that many on Kull considered purely mythical. One of the fourth stage Sleers kept still. The other swung its head from side to side, as if excited to be about the chase, but not yet taken off the leash. Then, abruptly, it surged forwards and bore down on Mr. Crane. The golem immediately turned and ran, full pelt, into a narrow side canyon. Like some giant, charging bull, the monster had difficulty turning in after him, kicking up rocks and debris as its huge weight bore down on 4 feet. It skidded and crashed into the side canyon's wall as it attempted to pursue him inside. It paused for a moment, perhaps puzzled as to why he had entered this blind alley, and was now standing, perfectly motionless, at the far end. But the delay was only brief. Then it went in after him. Crane just waited and watched as the monster bore down on him. His next actions would be dictated by a minuscule fraction of one fragment of his wrecked mind. The Sleer was big, it was heavy, and its eating utensils could certainly damage him. Therefore, he must avoid them. He squatted suddenly, and as the Sleer drew close, he straightened up his legs with the full force of their industrial torque motors, leaping high above and to one side of the creature. It slammed into the canyon wall, shattered sandstone and dust raining down all about it. Mr. Crane's lace-up boot came down briefly on a narrow ledge. Then he bounced back out and down, landing astride behind the Sleer's head, which it was shaking furiously from side to side as it backed up the way it had come. The beast then froze as it processed this new input into its already stunned brain. Crane helped it in making a decision by closing his thighs hard enough to start cracking the forward carapace. The enraged Sleer began to buck and thrash its body from side to side. Its ovipositor, whirling like a drill bit, stabbed again and again over above Crane, but the Sleer could not twist it low enough to strike him. Rolling up his sleeves, he then stabbed the blade of one hand into the back of the monster's head, 3 times, to break through the thick carapace. The Sleer rolled, trying to dislodge him, but as it came back upright, its passenger was still in place, just having lost his hat. He rubbed a hand over his bare, brassy skull, then thrust that same hand deep inside the Sleer's head, and methodically began to tear out its contents. The Sleer tried smashing its back against the canyon wall to dislodge him. Failed. Crane continued excavating glistening nodules and scarves of pink flesh, rubbery masses of tubes and handfuls of quivering jelly. Eventually the creature's movements became spasmodic, when not painfully slow. It walked sideways up towards one canyon wall, leant there as if resting, then walked sideways towards the other wall, but never made it. Suddenly the life went out of the beast, as if Crane had pulled its power plug. Its legs gave way, and with a sigh, it collapsed. After dismounting, Mr. Crane used sand to clean his hands, rolling the gore away in balls, just like the Sleers he had watched earlier had shed sand mixed with their mating juices. It took some time doing this, occasionally glancing back towards the main canyon. Once his hands were pristine again, he used the edge of a sulabane leaf to scrape much of the Icarus mess off his coat. Only then did he look around for his hat. Seemingly undamaged by its brief departure from Crane's head, it was lying over by the far wall of the canyon, where first-stage sliers had bored numerous burrows. He walked over, stooped, and picked it up, straightened it, and brushed away the dust. Only as he was placing it on his brass skull did he notice the blue eye gleaming in shadow. Then the great cobra thing hurtled out and slammed into his chest, bore him to the ground, and pinned him there, smoke boiling away around it as if it were the contact head of a giant spot welder. Crane struggled to rise, then slumped back like the sleer he had just killed. The dragon pseudopod remained connected to his chest for some time. Then, as if having thoroughly drained its victim, slid back into the sleer burrows. Crane remained motionless, deep down inside himself. There were all sorts of interesting and complex compounds floating about in the air. The pollution produced by a nascent industrial society. But as he walked through the streets of the Overcity, Skeller also noticed oddities that could only result from such industry ascending from a basis of a previously acquired body of knowledge. The phocells were a prime example. Photoactive electricity was not something you stumbled across in a society where people still used oil lamps and candles. Another such example was invisible to the few citizens still up and about this night, but not so to Skellor. He tracked the neat line of red-shifted photons spearing up from the tower below which he now stood. This edifice was a steel column topped by a small dome, from which protruded the cylinder of an optical telescope. Yet certainly it was not that item which was producing the laser beam. Still invisible, Skellor entered the building and began to climb a winding stair. A ticking, hissing sound followed him up as his creatures first walked to heel, then spread out at his silent command. Here he found some night people whose work concerned the sky and the stars. "A message laser," he observed, standing over a woman in a corridor, convulsing as an org insect bored into her skull. All around him, his creatures were taking over the inhabitants of the tower, one after another, and through them he was tracking everybody down. Two mechanics in grease-stained, ankle-length coats fell in behind him as he came to the upper viewing chamber. His creatures instantly took a man and woman as they pored over their calculations, but the old man, standing thickly wrapped against the cold, gazing through the telescope's traversal slot, he left alone for a moment. Someone had bolted the message laser to the side of the telescope, probably because the positioning mechanisms of the telescope could aim it accurately. The beam itself, Skellor now knew, having extracted the information from many minds, was produced by a ruby wrapped in one of the magnesium bulbs whose production process it had taken this man, Stollar, 10 years to perfect. It was also through this device that they hoped to bring down one of the landing craft from the Ogygian, though Skellor doubted their primitive computing powers were up to the task. Stollar turned. "Who? What is..." He looked in horror at his assistants. took in their vacant expressions, the things attached to the sides of their heads and others of their kind swarming about the floor. "You're the one it warned Tanaquil about." With a nod, Skellor acknowledged the speed of the man's mind.
"It?" he asked. "The Sand Dragon?"
That came as a rude reminder, almost like a slap to wake him. Skellor focused his attention on Crane's control unit, and only then realized how smoothly it had been taken out of his control. There was no contact now, no contact with the golem at all. But something was still subverting the control unit inside Skellor himself, some subtle infiltration.
"You are controlling all their minds!"
Stolar's horror was intense, his face chalk white, as he stepped up onto the first rung of one of the telescope's maintenance ladders to try to get further away from Skellor. Skellor had no further time for the man. He shifted Jane's substructure inside himself, coughing at the reluctance of the device to move, his eyes watering in reaction to this thing caught in his throat.
"How many do you control?"
Hysteria now in Stoller's voice. Skellor released his hold on the org creatures, and they scuttled towards the other man. He coughed, hacked, then spat up the black stone of the control module.
"Damn you, dragon!"
He looked up in time to see Stoller stepping back through the traversal slot, trying to claw away the creature attached to one side of his head. He fell. The link was just going in when Stoller hit the unyielding metal of the platform below. His death was instantaneous, but not, unfortunately, sufficiently thorough. Skellor turned to go and make his way down. He wouldn't waste a mind like that. All that was required was a few repairs. Retroact 14. Crane dropped from the Otter Hunter's outrigger and hit the copper salt sea with the curtailed splash of a lead fishing weight. Foam white surrounded him briefly, then he was sinking fast, trailing large lens-shaped bubbles made by air escaping his clothing. The bottom of his coat flared out around his legs, and he clamped his right hand firmly on his hat to hold it in place. Looking down, he momentarily thought he was seeing the bottom, until light reflected from scales in the green mass below him as the shoal of adapted whitebait swirled away. Then, finally and abruptly, the bottom came up with a crump against his hobnailed soles. Glittering silt spread in a cloudy ring from his impact point, then quickly settled. The seabed here was almost entirely composed of shell fragments and whole shells, trumpet shells with their distinctive banding, the bone-white carapaces of pearl crabs, like miniature human skulls, iridescent penny oysters, sharp scythe shells, and the occasional dull bronze gleam of dark otter bone. Taking his bearing from his internal compass, Mr. Crane turned until he was facing in the right direction and began striding towards the distant shore.
"You must be merciless and swift. Kill anyone who gets in your way. They don't matter. But be sure to get Alston."
In one fragment of Crane's mind, the perfectly recorded image of a man behind a pedestal-mounted harpoon gun, him swinging the gun around and firing, braided wire snaking out after the barbed missile with a hiss like cold flesh dropped into scalding oil. Enough for face recognition.
"I bet that smarts you, little fucker."
Enough for voice recognition. Complex pheromones, a fingerprint of the exudations of one human life. Crane even knew how Alston smelt. Pelter had not stinted on providing the information for recognition. In another fragment of the Golem's mind, a detailed library describing the numerous functions of the human body, how it lived, and in mirror image, the numerous ways Crane could halt those functions. There was no emotional baggage attached. It comprised no more than a dry scientific description of how to turn off the human machine. Pelter's order acted across these two fragments. In the first, how to locate one specific human. In the second, how to cause that same human to cease functioning. Anyone who gets in your way, being unspecific, was more problematic, and interaction with other partially disconnected fragments coloured Crane's basic actions. Gets in your way depended on Crane's location. Pursuing order, Crane surmised sea, island, anyone, Alston. He decided to be methodical. The bottom abruptly dropped away, and soon Crane was stumbling down a slope, as if all this time he had been walking on the spoil heap from a seafood plant. Then he stepped from shell onto the clay bottom of a channel, sinking up to his calves before his boots hit something firm. The surge of current from one side carried silt in a jet stream away from where he stepped, shooting to his left and out of sight behind more mounded shell. But this current caused him no more problem than having to hold his hat in place. At each step, tube worms emerged from the clay and gasped out their feeding heads like white daffodil flowers, as if Crane's weight was bearing down on some soft, hidden, communal body lying underneath. The dark otter threw a shadow before it from the glittering surface above as it came hurtling up the channel against the current, probably tracking the cause of the silt disturbance. It was the limbless, pelagic form, black as coal and 10 meters from the tip of its long tail to the massive carp gape of its toothless mouth. It dipped its head towards Crane, and, perhaps knowing the shape he bore was poison to it, then swung up and circled above him. Many of its kind had, over the years, made themselves ill by trying to eat human corpses deliberately dumped into the sea precisely to teach that point. If it did attack him, Crane would define it as part of the mentioned anyone. But the creature soon lost interest and continued up the channel and out of sight. Reaching the other bank, Crane climbed for 10 meters up through tumbling shell the currents had mounded along the rim of an underwater stone plateau. This plateau provided a more stable environment for the life that preferred to inhabit the shallower waters near the island. To his right, a fanfare of trumpet shells jutted and waved above a bed of penny oysters. Single kelp-like trees spread canopies in the waves, fracturing the sunset light, and in their tentacular branches, pearl crabs fluoresced like Christmas lights. Slightly to the left of his current course, one such tree was particularly bright with nacreous luminescence. Crane changed his course to bring him there. This delay was acceptable, as Pelter had given no time limits, only the vague instruction to be swift. Caught, hanging in the convoluted branches, legs dangling down the spiral trunk, the burned and broken corpse seemed a crucified pearly king, or some macabre decoration in a casino town. Crane recognized Semper only after a recognition program propagated across 5 of his mind fragments, which connected to his library of human biology and physiology, and Crane then worked out how the man had looked. He reached up and tugged at one skinless foot. Semper dropped from the sea tree, and, trailing pearl crabs and a small shoal of steel-blue fry, slowly sank to the bottom. What Alston had done to this man, Crane recognised. How could he not recognise Serban Klein's gift to himself? How could he fail to recognise that thing he had fragmented himself to escape? He moved on. What was it that coloured his actions when he finally reached the island shore? The emulation of the emotion, or rage itself? Retroact ends. Chapter 16. A spaceship, even a clunker centuries old, is a complex and valuable piece of hardware. So most owners of such, including private individuals, ECS, and the many other organisations gathered under the Polity AI umbrella, work on the principle of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and if it works, don't throw it away. That is the reason for the wide variety of interstellar and in-system ships now prevalent. It is why you will see old iron-drive landing craft operating alongside craft exclusively using anti-gravity, and every evolution of landing craft in between. In interplanetary space, you'll find ancient iron-drive liners operating beside the most modern fusion-drive craft, great ram-scoop cargo haulers, or survey craft propelled by chemical rockets. Crossing interstellar space are ships centuries different in design, using all the aforementioned engines for their in-system work, plus radically different U-space drives too. In the most modern ships, that drive will be a discrete machine contained at the core. In the older ships, balanced U-space engines are in dual, triform, or quadrate format. These are normally positioned outside the ship on piers, to distance the mind-bending drive energies from the ship's crew and passengers, who often need also to travel either in hibernation or sedated. From How It Is by Gordon. The plain was an ancient seabed, scattered with salt pans left as, over many centuries, the sea had evaporated. Weathering had revealed fossil remains, boulders containing crystals of smoky quartz like inset windows to a cold furnace, and fields of stones sieved out of the ground by the perpetual wind. Arden, during her long sojourn here, had journeyed a great deal within the perimeter allowed her. She had found a wonderful, fossilised 12-metre ancestor of an Apec, all glittering iron pyrites and opalised carapace, and, acceding to her request, Dragon had sealed it under a layer of some tough substance similar to chain glass. She had found diamonds, emeralds, star rubies and sapphires, as well as other nameless gems, and with the disquietingly organic mechanisms Dragon manufactured for her inside itself, had cut and polished them. For a woman whose lifetime areas of study had been xenobiology and xenogeology, it had been an interesting time, and only as a matter of principle had she regularly protested against Dragon's imprisonment of her. She supposed her patience stemmed from having been born within the polity. With all the benefits of a genetically enhanced body and a seemingly limitless lifespan, what was the hurry? Because of Arden's long and detailed study of the plane, she knew precisely when she reached the area Dragon had excavated and then replaced above itself. Not because the land level was higher here, as there were many such areas across the plain, but because of the meticulousness of the geology. The boulders, with their quartz inclusions, were placed just so. The stone fields looked as if they had been raked, and single fossils were placed artfully on dusty surfaces. There seemed something akin to a Japanese stone garden about it all, or of some display in a polity museum. Trudging back from the edge of the plain, her pack of light camping equipment slung from one shoulder, she recognised a particular boulder with a seemingly wind-excavated hollow under one side of it, and veered from this signpost to head for her home, the one she possessed here anyway. Then she jumped in surprise, dropping a lump of pale yellow beryl she had just found, when one of Dragon's pterodactyl heads slid out from underneath that same boulder and rose above her with a hissing roar.
"No, Jane, just Crane," it said cryptically, gazing back the way she had come.
"And what's that supposed to mean?" Arden hissed, stooping to pick up the fallen beryl. "You said this Skellor guy is loaded with the stuff."
The head swung towards her.
"He is, but the golem android he has sent here as his ambassador, though showing signs that it once contained Jane Mycelia, is now free of that parasite."
"Ah, the metal skin android Vulture mentioned. He's called Crane?"
"Mr. Crane. He's very specific about that."
"Should be interesting," Arden opined. Dragon blinked.
"You intend to remain?"
"You want me to go, just when things are livening up?"
"Maybe too lively,"
said Dragon.
"Polity ships now."
"Here for that Skellor?"
"The ship is called the Jack Ketch."
It took Arden a moment to dredge her memory for what that name meant. She remembered the historical context and rumours of other things, hints of AI atrocities, brief and bloody annexations and border wars. But then it gave some polity citizens a bit of a buzz to talk of such things. It was like sitting round the campfire telling ghost stories. "Ah," she said.
"A telefactor comes, watched by Vulture."
"Will you let it through the barrier?"
"Maybe. And now a landing craft has launched."
Events, it seemed, were moving apace, and Arden realized that her long stay on this plane with her enigmatic companion was ending. As she continued towards her comfortable cave, she could not help but feel a little sad about that. Anderson gazed over to the other side of the corrals, recognizing the vehicles from the Mineraleer's encampment. No doubt the moisture-induced growth spurt had driven them away from their excavations.
"Why do we have to leave so early?" Turgle complained.
"Because Unga Salbeck is deeply asleep, but I don't know how much longer that will be the case," thought Anderson.
"Because I want to get through all the greenery before it makes travelling difficult," replied the knight, as he paid off the bleary-eyed corral keeper.
"It's because of that woman," said Turgle. "You want to avoid a confrontation with her."
Anderson turned away, ostensibly to watch Bonehead peek his sensory head from under the skirt of his carapace, then jerk it quickly back in the hope Anderson hadn't noticed. He had rather enjoyed his confrontation with Unga, but it was not something he wanted to extend. As soon as immediate lust was gratified, he knew she would begin slowly extending their brief encounter, querying his choices, lightly discussing future scenarios in which they would be together, elbowing her way into his life.
he justified his abandonment of her by telling himself there was something a bit twisted about a woman loving the killer of her brother, but that did not entirely assuage his feeling of guilt. Entering the corral to thump his foot against Bonehead's shell, he wondered briefly if his fleeing the situation here might be more to do with its possibilities than its perversity. Such an inclination to escape complications had separated him from Unger on 5 previous occasions, and was, probably, the reason he had been on the road for most of his life. Climbing up onto the sandhog's back, then plumping himself down in the saddle, he recognized that cowardice came in many forms. With a reluctant hissing and creaking, Bonehead lurched to his feet. Mounting stone, Turtle observed,
"You know, maybe it'd be better if you sorted things out here. You don't want her to catch you unawares."
Anderson let out a bark of laughter. He couldn't help himself.
"Will you ever trust me?"
Turtle asked. Anderson did not reply to that. "Talking about unawares." He eyed the uniformed metalliers moving out from the shadows between nearby buildings. Turtle glanced towards them.
"One of them cornered me last night after you disappeared. Very curious to know all about me, where I was from and where I was going. My replies were understandably limited."
He looked round at Anderson.
"I wonder if it's anything to do with that explosion last night."
"Explosion?
You didn't feel it? The damn buildings moved. How could you sleep through that?"
"Clear conscience." Anderson winked. Turtle looked at him askance, then returned his attention to the uniformed men approaching. Anderson called out,
"How can I help you?"
A metallier, similar in dress to Kilnsman Gyral, peered into a book he was holding.
"You're Anderson Endrick, a Rondeur Knight."
"I certainly am." The man nodded.
"Where are you heading now, and to what purpose?"
Anderson eyed the others. They were armed, he had noticed that last night, and they seemed quite edgy.
"Up to the plains? But as to my purpose," he shrugged, "maybe to hunt a sand dragon. Maybe just to take a look."
The man nodded and closed his book.
"Who are you looking for?"
Anderson asked.
"Don't rightly know. Someone dangerous, alone, and heading in towards Golgoth. So that puts you in the clear."
He stared from one to the other of the pair.
"Just so long as you don't head towards Golgoth."
"Is it something to do with that explosion last night?"
Turtle asked. The man gazed over his shoulder into the buttes.
"Could be. Some strange things happening lately."
He stepped aside and waved them ahead. As he and Anderson departed the concrete road and headed back towards the route they had been travelling the previous day, Turtle suggested,
"Perhaps we've already seen who they're looking for."
"Heading in the wrong direction," Anderson observed.
He glanced back.
"I don't know why, but I feel we're well out of it. I don't like it when lots of people start running around with guns. Makes me nervous."
Soon, the Metalier Road and Roadhouse were out of sight behind them, and they were travelling through a transformed landscape. The Sulabane plants were now knee-high to a human, but presented no problem for the 2 sandhogs. Joining the yellow fungus smearing the canyon walls were black and white checked nodules, things like pale green street lamps and the occasional long, shelf-like bracket fungus, alternately white and transparently banded. Green fronds had also exploded from the ground in many places, exposing the flesh-red underground volvi in which they had been coiled. but it was the sudden faunal activity on which the two travellers kept a wary eye. Stilt spiders and sliers swarmed through the vegetation, though luckily nothing large enough to take on a sand hog. So the two of them, like white hunters on elephants, could view the activity of these alien tigers. Female sand gulpers no longer fed in lines spaced across the canyons, but clumped together in herds around the smaller males, who now carried burdens of tubular eggs on their backs. Snapper beetles were everywhere, though dispersed now, such was the extent of the bounty on offer. And patches of ground in damper, shadier places writhed with the activity of cliff eels. By midday, nothing having tried to attack them, Anderson called a halt so that they could push aside Sulabane ground leaves and collect sand oysters, which they then ate raw while they travelled. It was only some minutes after this, as he was tossing a shell to one side, that he spotted the pursuing sand hog.
"Oh, hell," he said.
"That woman," muttered Turgle, reaching for his weapon. Anderson waved a calming hand.
"Put it up, boy. I mislaid you somewhat about her. She certainly doesn't want me dead."
The hog Unger rode stood a man-height taller than Bonehead, was ruddy-coloured and leaner. Anderson recognised a thoroughbred, similar to those used in the races held in Provence. As Unger drew it to a halt beside him and glared down, he winced.
"Once again," she said, "you failed to say goodbye."
"You should know me by now, Unger."
"I think I do. But it has taken this last time to finally open my eyes. This, Anderson Endrick, is the last time I chase after you. Our love affair, to my mind, has been far too intermittent and too often spoilt by my knowledge of how you like to put yourself in danger."
"The nature of my job," Anderson explained.
"It doesn't need to continue so.
It's all I know."
"We talked about alternatives. I have a place in Provence. Come there with me now."
Anderson looked regretful.
"Things to do. I can't abandon them now."
Unger glanced at Turgle, then turned again to Anderson.
"Boys' games. I give you 3 months to take up my offer. Then I take up other offers made to me."
Tapping her goad against one side of her hog's carapace, she turned it back the way she had come.
3 months, she repeated,
then whacked the goad down hard. As it hurtled away, the big, lean hog tore up vegetation.
"Perhaps you'll explain," said Turgle.
"She wants her husband," Anderson admitted.
"And this is the great danger you've been avoiding?"
Anderson shrugged. Turgle went on,
"If I hadn't seen you kill that third stager..."
He shook his head. Later that day, Turgle came to feel that the knight should concentrate on avoiding dangers of greater lethality.
"Personally, Fethan would rather have gone down to the surface of the planet than come across to this ship, but the order to do so had been emphatic, and so closely linked was he to the savage creation of Jerusalem inside him that Fethan did not like to contemplate what might be the consequences of disobeying it. Gazing at the ship through his visor, he realized it must be ancient, centuries old at least. It was a colony ship, one of those sent out before the invention of the Runcible, before the Quiet War or AI takeover and the Praedor War,
humanity's first encounter with hostile aliens. Probably, on its very basic U-space drive, it had taken ages to reach this location before the colonists could wake up and disembark.
"Jack," he said suddenly. "The landers."
"Elaborate, please," the AI replied.
"Well, did they all parachute down?"
There was a beat, a positive infinity in AI terms. "There are three landers attached to the central body of the ship. Presumably they were used to ferry the colonists and their supplies to the surface. Then they were recalled to the ship."
"You're thinking in AI terms."
"Is this relevant to our purposes here?" asked Jack.
"I am an attack ship, not an archaeologist."
"It might have some bearing on the situation below. If no return journey were intended, the colonists would have been daft not to make use of those landers. They'd have stripped out the ship too."
"Please, let me know when you find out what occurred."
Jack managed to inject bored sarcasm into his tone. As they drew closer to it, Fetham began to grasp the sheer scale of the ship. "There would have been thousands of colonists," Sento observed abruptly, "and hundreds of crew." Fetham did not disagree, but the golem continued. "A ship like this was designed almost as a cargo carrier. The colonists would be in cold sleep, packed away just like the supplies the ship also carried. Even the crew would spend most of their time frozen, only being woken to perform essential maintenance tasks during the journey."
"Where we look first?" Fethan asked.
"One of Jack's telefactors has made an airlock in the sphere section operable."
"Okay."
The telefactor was clinging to the hull like a great iron mosquito, its proboscis injecting the power to run the airlock that lay open beside it. Finally reaching the lock, they entered into the light cast by a malfunctioning fluorescent and by the plastic control buttons below a flickering screen. Once they were inside, the outer door hinged shut, then the inner one hinged open, gusting vapour into the lock. Fethan checked his suit reading and realised that the air mix would asphyxiate a human. Overriding his suit's safety devices, he removed his helmet and sniffed.
"Dusty cellar with a hint of scrapyard," he said.
Removing his own helmet, Sento said, "I smell oxidised metal and ketones."
"Like I said."
Bethan led the way further into the ship. The tubular shaft leading from the airlock had sets of four doors spaced evenly around its perimeter at regular intervals, and traversing handles all down its length. When they came to a radial intersection with six branching shafts, Fethan halted and moved back.
"Let's take a look in one of these."
He gestured to one of the four doors just before the intersection.
"This all looks like it might get a bit repetitive."
Luckily, the electrically operated door had an inset manual handle. Fethan took hold of this and attempted turning it in the direction indicated on the handle itself. Something clinked, and it moved freely, detaching from the door with a slight tug.
"Brittle,"
he observed, pushing himself along to the next door. Sento went over to another door to try that. Between them, they managed to snap off every handle. Fethan unshouldered his APW and began winding the setting of the weapon down to try and find something manageable. "Perhaps not advisable in here," said Sento. "It would be like trying to use an electric saw to cut wet tissue paper. And anyway, I've been here before." Sento stabbed his hand through a laminate of thin metal shell over foamed insulation. Then, getting a grip, his feet braced under a traversing handle, he heaved sideways, causing mechanisms to snap and crunch in the wall. Soon he had pushed the door far enough into the wall cavity for them to enter the room beyond.
"Impressive," said Fethon, again shouldering his weapon. "Ain't sure I could do that."
"Then get an upgrade." Cento led the way in. Fethon at once saw that they had entered one of probably hundreds of cryogenic storage chambers. The room was wedge-shaped, and transparent upright tubes, large enough to contain a person in each one, crowded the area like pillars, arranged with only narrow access between them.
"Hyperthermal storage," Cento said, reaching out and brushing his hand across one curved surface.
The golem was right. This was an old method of cryogenic storage, stemming from research into animal hibernation. People were pumped full of various exotic drugs and gen-factored enzymes before having their temperatures reduced to just above freezing point by being drowned in saturated brine. They were unconscious when this happened, and their bodies constantly monitored thereafter. But there were risks in this old-fashioned method.
1 in 40, said Fethon. The chances were 1 in 40 that you'd never wake up.
Cento, rather than reply, simply pointed. The man floated, dead and pickled, in the liquid initially used to preserve him for another life. From cannulas in his arms and chest, tubes snaked to sockets at the top and bottom of the cryotube. Monitoring must have been done via radio implants, because there were no wires attached to him.
"He could probably be revived now," said Cento.
Fethon looked at the golem in surprise.
"In another body," Cento added.
Fethon returned his attention to the corpse.
"Adapted," he said,
indicating the lip tendrils and wrist spurs.
"I wonder if it was for the planet below. I don't recognize this format."
"It's one of the first types, spliced from other Terran life by viral recombination," Cento informed him. "Reptile and fish DNA was used to give humans greater tolerance of extreme heat and cold."
"For the planet below, then?"
"Maybe. It was also used to increase the odds of surviving hibernation." Over the next hour, they discovered the sphere section of the ship was packed with cryotubes and empty holds that had once contained the colonists' supplies. A single monitoring area, with attached living quarters, occupied the center of the sphere. Here, taking their turns at revival, colonists would live for a few months whilst making necessary repairs and checks.